Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. I'm Saskia Epstein, Senior Vice President of PNC, alongside my co-host, Carolyn Jones, Market President and Publisher of the Boston Business Journal.
Thanks, Saskia. It's great to be with you on PNC C-Speak. Each podcast features local executives talking about relevant and timely business topics. This knowledge-sharing platform showcases leaders with forward-thinking approaches that disrupt the status quo and cause us to think differently. Our guest today is Jim Canales, president of the Barr Foundation.
Jim, welcome. We're so excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Having seen the slate of guests that you've had on the podcast, I'm honored to be included with such a stellar group of leaders from across the region.
That's a great start because this is the Movement Maker miniseries, highlighting leaders who are advancing equity in our city and who were recognized on the Power 50 list by the Boston Business Journal. Thank you, Carolyn, for doing that. That's maybe a perfect introduction and segue. We'd love to hear a little bit more about your work at the Barr Foundation and its mission here in Boston.
Terrific. So the Barr Foundation is a relatively new foundation. We were created in 1997, so we've just passed our 25th year. It was a foundation created by Barbara and Amos Hostetter, who are Boston residents. And over time, the foundation has grown to be a sizable institution. Our endowment today stands at about $2.6 billion. And last year, we awarded close to $140 million in grants, largely across the New England region, although we also do some selective national grant making too. The foundation's mission is to invest in potential, put simply. And we focus in three broad areas, arts and creativity, climate, and education. And then we have a number of other special initiatives, which I know we'll get into over the course of the conversation today. I should also say that we have now for well over a decade had a wonderful fellowship program where we honor a group of about a dozen leaders, generally from the nonprofit sector, called the Barr Fellows Program. And that network of fellows has now grown to some 70 plus leaders from across the region, whom you will see in leadership roles in not just the nonprofit sector, but also in the public sector and in some cases in business. And we're really proud of that network, which has grown and expanded over time.
Jim, as a former nonprofit exec myself, I can tell you that is a coveted opportunity among nonprofit leaders, and the impact has been tremendous. I'd love to talk a little bit more about your leadership and journey, both to the Barr Foundation and then spearheading its important work in this region. Tell us how you got there and what did the path look like along the way?
So I started my career as a high school English teacher in San Francisco. I'm a native San Franciscan and went to college down on the peninsula in the Bay Area and then moved back to San Francisco, where I taught high school for 5 years, was also the dean of admissions. It was a small independent school. And it's interesting because as I often think about my career, I think once a teacher, always a teacher. And in so many respects, the skills that I learned as a classroom teacher that run the gamut from how do you put a lesson plan together to how do you keep rambunctious teenagers engaged in a topic. Those are all skills that I think have been useful in the work of the work that I now do leading a foundation here at Barr. My career path then took me to the James Irvine Foundation in California, which is a foundation that's roughly the same size as the Barr Foundation, also a regional foundation. And I spent over 20 years at the Irvine Foundation in a variety of roles. And the last 11 years, I was the CEO of the foundation prior to coming to Boston and to being asked to lead the Barr Foundation in 2014.
And that's a big move to Boston, although I think of San Francisco as a sister city on both coasts. There are a lot of parallels. What was the magnetic pull or drove you to make that move?
So I'll be very honest, I was not looking for a new opportunity. I was very happy in the Bay Area and also very happy at the Irvine Foundation, where I'd had a great career and had enjoyed the work a great deal. And really, it was the opportunity to come to Boston and to work closely with Barbara and Amos Hostetter as they were envisioning the next stage of evolution for the Barr Foundation. At that point in time, Barr had been around for about 16, 17 years. It had grown significantly during that time. But as many people may know, Barr was anonymous for the first dozen years of its existence. And so for half of the time that we have been around, we were an anonymous foundation, and the foundation was just beginning to step out to becoming more public about the work that it was doing and beginning to experiment with using its own voice. And so it was around that time that the conversations with Barbara and Amos brought them to me. And we talked about what it would mean to come here and partner with them, not only to grow the foundation, to think about the programmatic expansion of the foundation, certainly the operational growth of the institution, but also to think about governance. And we've made a number of changes on that front, which I'm also happy to talk about. And as I'm sure many listeners well know, the foundation has a very different public profile today than it did in 2014 when I arrived. And that's just been part of the evolution that we've been undergoing at Barr.
What you just said segues a little bit into this next question. Based on you sharing with us some of your background, you've worked in the philanthropy space for some time. And talking about the evolution of the Barr, you know, people don't always connect that philanthropic work with business directly. So how do you see the role of philanthropy as a key partner, you know, when addressing some of the challenges and opportunities in communities?
I so appreciate the question, Carolyn, because I think that when we do the kind of work that we do in philanthropy and work principally through and with nonprofit organizations in the work we do, I think we get siloed in a way, and it sort of gets viewed as, that's the work of the nonprofit sector and philanthropy is there to support the nonprofit sector. And that is true. But I also think when you look at the magnitude of the challenges that we are focused on at many foundations focus on big challenges. At Barr, we happen to focus on how do we elevate the arts and how do we think about the role of culture and creativity? How do we address climate change, which is one of the most pressing challenges of our time? How do we make sure young people are educated and ready to enter the world? So those are all huge challenges. And in my view, these are challenges that require the engagement of a broad range of sectors to address them effectively. And so we in philanthropy, even with our resources, we need partnership with the business community. We need partnership with the public sector. And certainly we need partnership with our own partners in the nonprofit sector to advance these concerns that we all share. So I think this notion of ensuring that we are keeping lines of communication open, that there are opportunities for us to learn from one another, to engage one another, and to think about how we can be constructive partners to implementing the solutions that we see to the challenges before us, I think that's something that we keep front and center in the work that we do at Barr.
Talk about that a little bit more. What does that look like when philanthropy and business and the nonprofit sector are partnered to drive change?
Let me, if I could, talk about a couple of examples in our work at Barr, which might help to animate that general concept. So one is a project that we have been involved in even prior to my arrival. So in 2010, Mayor Menino and Amos Hostetter, one of our co-founders, created something called the Green Ribbon Commission. And in some ways, it was ahead of its time. The purpose of the Green Ribbon Commission was to bring together a broad cross-section of leaders from various sectors, as I just described, but with a real focus on the business community, and to think about how the business community could come together and support Boston as it was implementing its climate action plan, which was put together in 2010. And so again, Boston being ahead of its time, acknowledging the climate was going to be a pressing concern, was already a pressing concern, thought about this issue of how do we bring multiple sectors together to address this challenge. So Barr ended up playing an important role to convene the Green Ribbon Commission, to provide funding for the staffing for the Green Ribbon Commission, and ultimately to help to support a number of the projects that the Green Ribbon Commission has undertaken. So one such project has been helping Boston to think about its climate resiliency efforts. And that ultimately led to a report that many have seen called Climate Ready Boston. We're all aware of the challenges that we have, for example, with sea level rise. And there's been, as you know, lots of conversation about what it is meant to build in the seaport, which is an area that is so vulnerable to sea level rise. And so that study, that analysis and assessment to help us understand what science tells us about what we're going to see in the next 50 to 100 years. And even though that may seem a long time away, that has implications for how we build today, how we keep our neighborhoods safe and protected. And that work has been an important output of the work of the Green Ribbon Commission. So it's a piece of work that we've been proud of. We're delighted that subsequent mayoral administrations also remained engaged with the GRC. So Mayor Walsh became a co-chair when he took over, and then Mayor Janey and now Mayor Wu have all been key partners for the GRC, and the GRC continues its work now 13 years later, and we see it as an important partnership going forward. The second one that I'll highlight is more of an early stage body of work for us at BAR, but I know it's an issue that many of your listeners care deeply about. We are all deeply aware of the racial wealth gap. I think in 2015, particularly here in Boston, when the Federal Reserve did that very famous study, The Color of Wealth, which has been widely quoted and cited. And in particular, that one data point that really stood out to people, that the net worth of white families was $247,000 and the net worth of Black families was $8. That stark data point, I think, spoke to what we know is a reality, which is there is a significant gap in wealth across various races. And so building on the work of that study and thinking about what is the role that philanthropy can play to address the racial wealth gap, this is going to be a new area of work for us at BAR. And so we are starting to engage with other partners. We made about $15 million in grants last year as part of our first step toward the work that we would like to do at BAR on this issue. And we are now reconvened with a group of partners to work with the Fed to update that study from 2015, because that data is now 8 years old and it merits both closer reexamination and also probably a deeper level of analysis than was able to be done in 2015.
And the work on climate, I know that I've spoken to a couple of executives who I think were one of the grantees of your sabbatical, and they were working in that space. So the things that we can gain from that are amazing. So Jim, to talk a little bit about you as a leader, you know, you lead a very purpose-driven company, so culture and values are very important. And I wonder if you can share some insights about how you create really a great employee experience and culture inside the BAR.
I so appreciate that question, Carolyn, because I think any of us in leadership roles need to be attentive to the organization, the culture that is in our institutions. And one of the things that I often say to my colleagues, especially new colleagues, is that culture is not stagnant. And culture is something that everybody in the organization helps to shape and contributes to. And so I don't think of the culture at BAR as we have a mission statement, we have a set of core values. Those are very important to us. And certainly we hope that anybody who would choose to join the BAR Foundation would find those compelling and want to play a role to advance those. So that's kind of a given. But I think in terms of the day-to-day culture of the organization and how we operate, we benefit from new perspectives and new vantage points and the lived experiences of colleagues that join us. So culture at this institution is going to be constantly evolving and constantly being reshaped by the presence and engagement of new colleagues. In fact, as you know, when any of us are involved in job searches, we often talk about the fit, you know, what's the culture fit of an employee. And we've resisted that a little bit in looking at our own work about diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I know we're going to talk about a little later. We've resisted that notion of cultural fit because somehow it implies that, again, culture is something that is stagnant and it's a matter of bringing somebody in that will fit into that culture. I think we think of it as, how do we think about bringing employees into our organization who are going to help us to contribute to continuing to shape the culture aligned with that broad mission and the purpose of the work of the foundation?
Jim, I grew up in the nonprofit sector and for decades often encountered board members and other leaders who espouse the sort of virtue of bringing over business practices and models and thinking into the nonprofit sector. And now at PNC, I have come to believe that the business community can learn a lot from nonprofits, and particularly perhaps related to this culture piece, as we just did with your insight about culture fit, which is a common practice as we're looking at hiring. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are important to businesses, to our listeners, have been important in BAR's work culturally, sounds like being centered by you as a leader and showing up with greater emphasis in your external work as well. Can you talk a little bit about how that work sort of is shaped and perhaps pull out some of the lessons that you're seeing both at BAR and in the nonprofit sector that could perhaps be portable to the corporate community?
I would be happy to do that. And clearly, we have much to learn from one another across sectors and across communities. And certainly much of what we have done at BAR has been informed by what we have learned from the journeys and the work of many other institutions. So let me highlight maybe three key lessons for us at Barr in the work that we've done thus far focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which has been work that we've been undertaking now for almost 6 to 7 years. So this is not recent work. It's work that has been something that we've been committed to for some time. When we consciously started on our journey related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, one of the things that I did was to take time to talk to other leaders who had led their own institutions in doing DEI. And one of the things that I learned from those conversations was the importance of a leader creating an authorizing environment for DEI work. So what do I mean by an authorizing environment? It means that the leader is personally invested in the work. And one of the ways in which that is sometimes manifested is you see organizations putting together DEI committees. And many people shared with me that oftentimes the DEI committees became the province of younger staff of color and an opportunity for them to engage in the work of the organization. But there wasn't presence by senior leadership in the organization. There wasn't a sense that senior leadership was deeply invested in the work. And that sends a very important message in terms of doing this work. So for us at Barr, it was very important from day one that it was clear that I, as the president of the foundation, was going to be deeply engaged in this work. I have been on our DEI steering committee since its inception, continue to serve on it today. Our board chair, Barbara Hostetter, participated in many of the sessions that we did as a full staff for the first couple of years that we were doing this work. So again, both of those, I think, sent a very powerful signal about the importance of the work. The second thing I would say is that it's really important to realize this is long-term work. This is not doing a series of trainings. It's not bringing somebody in to do an implicit bias training and then you've done your DEI work and you can check that box. It really is about being willing to step into sometimes difficult, uncomfortable conversations where you're interrogating your own culture, you're looking at your own practices, you're examining where you as an organization might be falling short and what you're going to do about that. And that's really important to sit in those moments. And then the third thing I'll say, just to make it tangible, is we also thought that we need to look at our own practices and policies and say, if we care deeply about racial equity, how does that show up in our practices and policies? And so we put together some teams. And one of the teams that we put together looked at our leave policies, time off, holidays, paid leave, looking at sick leave. And I'll just spotlight one of the changes. We made many changes because of the work of that team. But one of the changes I'll spotlight is we changed our sick leave policy. So we used to have, as very traditionally, we had a use it or lose it sick leave policy, gave people a certain number of days, and it had to be used within a calendar year. And as we examined that policy through the lens of racial equity, we realized that there were a lot of problems with it. The use it or lose it sometimes created incentives and really the wrong incentives, oftentimes for parents or people who are caregivers, that if they themselves were sick, they wanted to save their time so that if their kids got sick, they could take time off to take care of their kids. So that was an important lesson for us. I think the other thing is a sick leave policy really doesn't accommodate the many reasons that people might need time off for health reasons. Sometimes they're mental health reasons. It's not about being sick. And so even the nomenclature can somehow imply that there's a stigma to taking time off to tend to your mental health. And that's not right. The other thing is that our health leave policy, our sick leave policy was very focused on family. And it didn't have a particularly expansive definition of family that accommodated loved ones, people in your life that are important that may not be family members, but you should be able to take time off to tend to their needs if that's important to you. And so as a result of all of that, not only did we changed it to health leave, not only did we expand the definition of how it could be applied, but we also made it unlimited. And I think this was a very powerful statement to our staff to say, this is grounded in trust. We are trusting you to use this when you need it. We are not going to keep track of it just for purposes of our own payroll system, but it's unlimited. People do not have a sick leave account that they can draw on and then it expires at a certain point. And now several years into this, I think it's gone quite well. And it really is a tangible illustration of taking concepts of diversity, equity, and inclusion and putting them to work in the practice of the institution.
That's a great example. I mean, because it really, really does dig down into not only, as you said, you know, let's do the work or have the class, or but it's really about what you're doing day to day. I mean, health leave, I admire that. I love that. That's really, really innovative. Jim, I wonder if on the DEI topic, you could talk a little bit more about some of the things you're doing with your staff. You had mentioned that you're taking a trip, the whole staff, to Alabama, which I think is extraordinary. So I wonder if you can tell a little bit about that.
Thank you, Carolyn. In fact, I shared in a blog post that I wrote in early 2020 that we were really excited because we were planning to take the staff to Montgomery and Birmingham, Alabama, as part of our ongoing learning around the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, with a particular focus on learning about the legacy of slavery and oppression and racial terror manifested through lynchings, which, you know, many people think, oh, that was many, many, many years ago. It was many years ago, but it was also much more recent that lynching remained a real thing in our country. And so, as many of your listeners may know, Brian Stevenson, the leader of the Equal Justice Initiative, helped to raise support for the creation of two institutions in Montgomery. One is the Legacy Museum, which examines our history of slavery. And it starts, the subtitle of the museum is From Slavery to Mass Incarceration. And it really tells that narrative story. And then the other institution that he helped to create there is the National Memorial to Peace and Justice, which is also known as the Lynching Memorial. And it's a memorial to those that we have lost to racial terror. And this is, I had the privilege of going there in 2019, along with the co-founders of the foundation, Barbara and Amos Hostetter. And when the three of us returned from that trip, we realized this was such a powerful experience. It would be important for the staff to also have benefit of that. And it's hard. It's very hard. But I also think it's important. It comes back to the point about discomfort and being able to sit in the discomfort of our history as a country and how much of that continues to manifest today in terms of systemic racism and oppression and bias and everything that we see. And that, I think, is important because that also influences the way we think about our work and how is it that our work can help to address some of these ongoing systemic issues that remain present today. So we are taking the staff in late April of this year, and we will be going to Montgomery and to those sites, also to Birmingham. And we're doing a side trip to Selma for people who can attend that optional day. And we're just, and we've done a fair amount of work to prepare for it. So it's been a significant investment of time and obviously financial resources to take a group of some 42 staff members there. But we think it's really important, and again, another manifestation of our deep commitment to racial equity and to thinking about how that plays out in the work we do at the Barr Foundation.
Yeah, that should be a transformative experience on many, many levels. That's amazing.
Jim, we're always so interested to talk with people who are deeply rooted in our city and driving equity and inclusion as you are. I think you have a particular unique vantage point also as a relative newcomer to Boston. Would love to hear your observations about the city and the outlook for the region. What are you optimistic about and what worries you?
I will say, to your point about relative newcomer, I'm struck that I think there are people here who've been here for multiple generations and still feel like relative newcomers to the region. So that seems to be, I do not count my 9 years here as in any way feeling that I'm deeply, deeply rooted, but it certainly has been enjoyable. I think what I'm really excited about, you mentioned earlier the Movement Makers series and the 50 individuals that were highlighted by the Boston Business Journal. What's been interesting to me is it's a city of lists and many institutions put out such lists. But even looking at the BBJ's list over the last, say, 5 years, the incredible commitment to ensuring that we're looking broadly at leaders across the region and in multiple sectors is manifested in that list. That list looked very different 5 years ago in terms of its makeup. And you look at the list today and there are a lot of younger people. It's certainly more diverse. There are certainly more women. And it certainly speaks to the cross-sectoral nature of leadership, not just in the business community. And business leaders play an important role, certainly, but we also all play a role in terms of addressing our city's challenges. So I've just been so pleased to see ways that we have been uplifting different leaders and leaders from different sectors and really highlighting the contributions that they're making. So deep, deep appreciation to you, Carolyn, and your colleagues at the BBJ for the work that you have done to do that. And it's been great to see many of our own grantees cited by you. In terms of what worries me, I would say, and I think this is probably a worry that is shared by many of your listeners, the increased polarization And the impact that that has in our inability to just have civil dialogue about the issues that are in front of us. And absolutely, we need to call out hate and racism and bigotry and behaviors that are offensive when those occur. So this is not about accommodating that. But it is about how do we create a space that allows us to have open dialogue where we can have respectful disagreement about issues. In our own diversity, equity, and inclusion work, we've done some learning about what it means to call people out versus what it means to call people in. And, you know, the notion of calling someone out is when someone says something that's offensive and you want to draw attention to that. And I think that there's a place for that to make sure that people are able to learn from those moments. At the same time, there's also a place for bringing people into conversation and having a spirit of curiosity and bringing grace to that discussion. So my hope is that we can collectively find ways to create those spaces where we can call one another in as we aim to build a better Boston.
That's a great call to action. Thank you.
Jim, a little bit more, I like to go back in a little bit more and learn again from you and the experiences you've had. So what's some of the best advice that you've been given? Could be work, could be about work or life. And then once you share that, perhaps also what's your best advice if like you look ahead to the next generation of executives or even the current group?
The co-founder of the Barr Foundation, Amos Hostetter, founded and built a very successful cable company that was then sold in the mid-1990s. And one of the things that Amos is fond of saying as a leader is that you hire great people, you give them lots of latitude to do their best work, and you're there as a resource if they need you, but otherwise you let them do their best work. And when Amos shared that with me during the process of interviewing for this opportunity, I found that so resonant because it very much resonated with my own perspective of what it means to be a leader. And when I think about the role of a foundation president, and I've now had the privilege of leading foundations for close to two decades now between the Irvine Foundation and the Barr Foundation, I ultimately boil down the role of a foundation president is a facilitator, an enabler, an empowerer. I mean, that's what I do. I hopefully hire terrific people in this organization and give them the latitude to go do the best work out in the field in partnership with others. I empower them, and we have the great privilege of having significant resources at our disposal that we can invest in the community. And I hope that my colleagues feel empowered to bring their very best, bold, creative ideas to me and to the board to be able to advance that broad mission and purpose. And I think about my role as just facilitating the work that we do as an institution and ensuring that we've got shared communication, that we're understanding what we're trying to do collectively. Sometimes I'm the spokesperson for the foundation, which I am privileged to do, and I do with great pride because I have such pride in the work of what we do here, but I have such great pride in the people who not only work at Barr, but the people that we're able to support through the grant making that we do. And then in terms of advice that I give to others, I often think about the role of mentorship. And this will not be new to your listeners, of course, but I do think carefully about how is it I benefited hugely from being mentored throughout my career. And so I think about ways, how do I pay that forward in terms of being able to mentor others? And I often say to young people as they're thinking about jobs and roles that, you know, focus less on, you know, the prestige or the name of the organization you're going to be working for and focus more on the culture. And is it a place that's going to empower you? Is it a place that's going to enable you to grow and to learn and to stumble? Is it a place where you're going to have people that are going to take you under their wing and help to promote you and advance you? So those are the kinds of questions that I think it's important to focus on as a younger career person.
Jim, we always close our episodes with some rapid fire questions as a way to help the audience learn a little bit about you. So off the top of your head, what are you currently reading and or watching?
So I just finished reading an interesting book called Our Missing Hearts by Celeste Eng, who's actually a local author. I'm in a book club. And so I will confess that if I were not in a book club, I would not read as avidly as I do, just because I read so much for work in terms of my day-to-day work. But Our Missing Hearts was dystopian, which is not necessarily the taste that I would bring to my reading. But what I appreciated about is back to the earlier conversation about the polarization that we see, it's really a view as to what that could look like in the future if we don't find ways to address it today. It's a wonderful book, Our Missing Hearts by Celeste Ng. One other quick thing I will say is there's a great business book I read last summer that has really become influential in our work here at Barr called The Four Pivots by Sean Ginwright. And in fact, Sean is about to come to Harvard as a professor, and I would highly recommend it. It's really influenced my thinking about the way in which we need to reorient the work, the kind of work that we do, particularly with a focus on DEI, called The Four Pivots.
Thank you for that. Typically, I ask for a Boston leader or organization to watch. That might be a tough one for you. If that's true, would love to hear about a cause that you're personally passionate about.
That is a tough one for me because it's almost like asking a parent who's your favorite child, given the range, the range of people that we get to work with. But I guess maybe I'll pivot it a slightly different way and say that I'll take the time to say, I hope that everyone listening to this podcast, if everybody listening would take one session every month, one coffee hour, one lunch session, to extend themselves to one of these up-and-coming leaders in our community, take them out for coffee, learn about their work, think about the network effect that that could have in terms of building community, building coalition, helping to broaden the network to address social change in this region. That's what I hope people can do. I feel that's the privilege of what I get to do every day, and I'm paid to do that. But I hope it's something that we can all do because there's some tremendous people out there doing really impactful work.
That's great. I love that you folded answers to both questions together. Okay, favorite spot in the city?
So I really enjoy going to the Embrace, you know, our newest public sculpture in the Boston Common and near where Carolyn and I actually both sometimes run into each other because we live in that neighborhood. And I would say that what I've been struck by, and the Embrace was unveiled in January, as you know, and this is Hank Willis's Thomas sculpture and homage to Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King and capturing the moment of their embrace when Martin Luther King won the Nobel Peace Prize. What has struck me every time I go by there is how activated that space is. Young people, old people, people really are drawn to the space. And it's also started to become a space for community when we have moments in our city. Think about Mel King's recent passing. That became a moment that drew people to the Embrace. It's become a moment for a place for community building, for healing, for mourning, for celebrating. I just love that. And it's only been around for 5 months. So I'm really excited to see how it continues to be activated in the years ahead.
Yeah, it's so impactful.
Jim, you are engaged in some serious business. What makes you laugh?
So it's funny. We did know that you were going to ask that question, and my communications director said to me, tell them that your communications director is hilarious. And that happens, that happens to be true. That does happen to be true. So if any of you want hilarity, meet Stefan Lanfer. But what I will say is my colleagues make me laugh. This is a very joyful place because I think we realize the incredible privilege of the work that we get to do and the people we get to meet. And being back in the office in our new hybrid context, it's been great to be back and to hear the joy in the office and the laughter that emanates. We have serious work, but that doesn't mean we have to take ourselves so seriously. And it's been really fun to just be back in community with my colleagues.
Great advice, and look forward to getting a few chuckles with Stefan. So finally, a wish for Boston.
I'm struck by, sometimes you read narratives of Boston and you hear about the shining city on the hill, the hub of the universe, all of these kind of aphorisms that have come to describe Boston. And I think a lot about aspiration, and I think aspiration is important, but I really get excited when aspiration gets realized. So my hope for Boston is I think we have a lot of aspirations here in Boston. My hope for Boston is that we can really push to realizing those aspirations. And if Boston can become that city that shows what it is to be a 21st century city that can indeed be that beacon, that shining city on the hill, that would be really exciting. I feel Barr has a small role to play in that, and we're going to roll up our sleeves and do our best to drive toward that outcome. But it's going to take many of us together driving to that vision of Boston at its very best. And I'm just excited for the opportunities to do that.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure to have you.
I just really appreciate the invitation and invite your listeners, if they want to learn more about Barr, to check out our website at barrfoundation.org. And thank you again for your time. What a great conversation.
It was terrific. Thank you so much.
And that wraps up another episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim, and for sharing your insights. I'm Saskia Epstein.
And I'm Carolyn Jones, and this is PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. Our guest today was Jim Canales, president of the Barr Foundation.
You can find C-Speak at bizjournals.com/Boston or on any of your favorite podcast platforms.
Until next time.